can remove those chemical weapons, restrict those chemical weapons, that's the ultimate end goal.
Alaska's congressional delegation weighs in on the debate over Syria. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state moves forward with its effort to export LNG natural gas to Japan.
It is a big deal. It boosts the credibility of Alaska's gas commercialization efforts.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A former legislator from Nenana is being fined $18,000 for breaking state ethics rules. An investigation found that Alan Dick, a Republican who served one term in the House, charged the state and his campaign account for the same travel expenses and that he let family members live in his legislative office. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez has more.
The Legislative Ethics Committee doesn't mince words in its decision. It reads, Representative Dick seemed to operate under the premise that rules and regulations regarding legislative travel did not apply to him. They say he had a cavalier mindset and that his lack of attention to detail was unacceptable for a public official. The committee found Dick in violation of 5 of the 8 charges brought against him, dismissing the rest for insufficient evidence. Dick admitted that he, his wife, and his son lived in his Fairbanks legislative office on and off last fall, at the height of the campaign season. The committee's investigation found that he kept sleeping items in his office and that staff saw him coming and going at all times of the day and night. Statute prohibits public resources from being used for private benefit, the idea being that you don't want people to treat state offices like their own hotel rooms or personal apartments to avoid paying rent, especially if there's no legislative purpose for it. The committee found that Dick required his legislative staff to prepare him for a Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce candidate debate while on state time. Dick told the committee that he was confused about whether that campaign activity could count as legislative work, which the committee scoffed at. Investigation interviews determined that his staff had constantly reminded him that doing campaign work on government time was inappropriate. The committee also found that Dick frequently charged the state and his own campaign fund for many of the same activities. The double charges were as small as $17 for a meal at McGrath and as high as $700 to cover the aviation mileage on his private plane. As punishment, Dick is being ordered to repay the state $3,500 for the inappropriate charges he submitted. The committee is also hitting him with the cost of the investigation, which came close to $15,000. Dick did not return a request for comment to explain his course of action. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
The debate over whether to attack Syria is extremely fluid right now. President Barack Obama, in a national address last night, called on Congress to delay a vote authorizing the use of force. Alaska's delegation has been skeptical of an attack. Joining us is APRN's Washington correspondent, Peter Granitz. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Lori.
Peter, delaying the vote gives a bit of political cover to the Alaska delegation, doesn't it?
It does. It also gives a bit of political cover to the president. It was unclear whether he had the 60 votes he needed in the Senate or the 218 votes he would have needed in the House. And some might even say he was very far away from getting either of those. It was unlikely that he was going to get the support of Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich, and he certainly was not going to get the support of Congressman Don Young for authorization to attack Syria. Delaying the vote gives the White House more time to lobby the Congress to. The president did not give a timeline in his speech Tuesday night. He did not say whether it would be weeks or months that he would give the diplomatic route time to unfold. He still may need a vote in Congress. And there has been a full throttle lobbying effort by the White House. Lisa Murkowski says she was at the White House Monday meeting with Vice President Joe Biden and seven other senators. Senator Begich says he's talked to the president, the vice president, the chief of staff, and that is not uncommon for anybody in the Senate today. He says that they're just answering any questions they might have. And Senator Begich was fairly coy on some of his questions, you know, in those conversations, but he still is skeptical. The president was on the Hill yesterday afternoon, Tuesday afternoon, making the case to both the Democrats in the Senate and the Republicans in the Senate, spending at least an hour, hour and 15 minutes in each of those groups.
The president gave tepid approval to an emerging plan to let Syria forfeit its chemical weapons to an international body. Syria would also have to agree to sign on to a chemical weapons ban. Does the delegation see this as a reasonable option?
They see it as a better option than war. I spoke with Senator Murkowski before she and her Republican colleagues met with the president for lunch at the Capitol, and she welcomed the emerging framework then.
If we can truly get them off the table, then the chemical weapons off the table, and then it's verified, and they're verified and they're destroyed, and that's something that we can demonstrate. I think that that's absolutely something we should be looking at.
She says she has concerns about the president's overall plan for the Mideast. Congressman Don Young, in a way that only Don Young could do, you know, praised the president for allowing the diplomatic route to unfold. He wouldn't give him too much credit, but he says this is the way to go. We should not go forward with this very fast attack. Regardless of the scope of it, it's just too rushed. It's also important to note that Don Young did, in fact, vote for the Iraq War Resolution in 2002 that gave President Bush the authority to attack Iraq in 2003. Senator Begich seemed to be on board yesterday as well, although he still sounds a bit skeptical. And this is, we'll hear from him right now. And this is before he met with the president at lunch.
You know, at this point, I have, concerns about the engagement we would have within any level of Syria, but I would say that if you can remove those chemical weapons, restrict those chemical weapons, that's the ultimate end goal.
Senator Begich says right there that is the ultimate end goal, but it's conventional wisdom that says accounting for all these chemical weapons is a daunting process at best in time of peace, let alone a civil war between two sides that we know very little about. So it's a fluid thing, like you said. It keeps moving on. But the overall feeling is that members of Congress are happy they don't have to vote right now. They can take a step back and see how this happens, see if they need to get involved. And the Republicans have long been the party of defense, and many of them do not want to take a vote against authorizing a war right now because that might make them look weak on defense. And as for the Democrats, they're in a tough place. They want to support a president to help him get his domestic agenda, but many Democrats are just fundamentally opposed to any kind of strike, and they don't want to have to vote against the president right now.
And Peter, to be clear, this lunch meeting that they had with the president was yesterday, Tuesday.
Right, Tuesday afternoon.
So, Peter, what now? What happens now?
Congress moves on. The Senate is debating what amounts to a nominal energy efficiency bill. It's nothing monumentous. And both chambers are getting ready to debate a bill funding the government that could come as early as later this week in the Senate and next week in the House. And they need to pass a bill saying, yes, we're going to stay open past October 1st. And then, mid-October, they're going to be looking at these major deadlines. They need to agree to increase the borrowing limit for the government. They need to stay afloat. There are a lot of things happening right now. For weeks we were talking about Congress being on recess, coming back to just 9 legislative days. This Syria debate ate a whole week out of the calendar. So when they come back from this coming weekend, they need to do a lot of work.
All right, Peter, thanks for that update.
Thank you.
That's APRN's Peter Granitz joining us from Washington, D.C. The state has committed to a formal working relationship with a major Japanese financial institution that wants to develop natural gas projects. Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan signed the Memorandum of Understanding with the Japan Bank for International Cooperation on Wednesday during a trip to Tokyo. The deal is basically an act of financial diplomacy. It establishes that both parties have a mutual interest in getting Alaska natural gas to Japanese markets, and there's a potential for the two to work together on financing a gas pipeline or an export facility. In a phone call from Japan, Sullivan said the agreement is about more than just this one bank. It's also a good signal to other investors about the viability of Alaska projects.
It is a big deal. It boosts the credibility of Alaska's gas commercialization efforts.
Alaska has pursued a major natural gas project for years, but development has regularly stalled out for cost reasons and disagreements between major stakeholders. It may become easier for independent energy producers to provide power to the grid. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska has agreed to review out-of-date statutes that some say are holding up renewable energy projects. APRN's Ann Hillman reports.
Alaska Environmental Power is trying to build a wind farm in Delta Junction, but they're having trouble coming to an agreement with the local power utility. The issue is cost. How much should Golden Valley Electric pay for the energy AEP produces? AEP's attorney, Teresa Klemmer, says the problem is partially caused by the state's antiquated regulations, which were written in 1982. So they brought the issue before the RCA and a packed galley of interested parties.
And our hope was that a rulemaking process would give a lot more clarity and reduce some of those barriers so that we can have more of these really good, cost-saving, beneficial renewable energy projects able to move forward.
Changing the regulations would not only impact larger independent power projects, it would also affect residential power producers with just one windmill or a set of solar panels. The RCA agreed to hear the petition, but the process could take over a year. It starts with a 45-day comment period. The council plans to hold a hearing in January. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an epic horse pack trip ends in Denali National Park.
Alaska or the Yukon is a really beautiful country, but it's not really a horse country.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The demand for rental housing is on the rise, but because of a lack of university-level programs, there aren't many people prepared to manage properties. To help remedy that problem, the University of Alaska Anchorage is putting the final touches on the new undergraduate Widener Program for Property Management and Real Estate. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
As the size of rental properties grow, so does the demand for a pool of college graduates who have the necessary education and experience to manage them. Unfortunately, according to Dean Widener, the head of Widener Apartment Homes, which manages a number of properties in Alaska and around the U.S., there aren't many people who fit that description. So his company and others like it have had to make do.
What we wound up with is taking maybe a restaurant waitress or somebody freshly out of school that we thought might be doing a good job at leasing and sort of throw it on the wall and hope that it worked out for both parties.
But he says the rate of failure was high.
As we grew, particularly, and we started having properties that were 100, 200, and 300 units, the business changes from about a $200,000 business a year to many millions per year. So all of a sudden, you've got a large, sophisticated business that requires some sophisticated thinking and analysis and action. And that's where the college graduate really comes in.
So, 10 years ago, Widener donated $1 million to UIA's College of Business and Public Policy to begin developing a real estate and property management program. Then, in 2009, Widener made an additional contribution of $3 million to really get the ball rolling. Much of that money went toward the endowment of the Widener Chair, which will play a crucial role in the development of the program and its students, according to the Dean of the College of Business and Public Policy, Rashmi Prasad.
The Widener Chair's role really is to help, almost to be an architect for the program, to make sure that it's connected to industry very well, to make sure that students are inspired and appreciate the the opportunities in this field, to counteract any misconceptions that they may have or preconceptions they may have.
At a recent event in UAA's Rasmussen Hall, where the business college is housed, Prasad announced lifelong Alaskan Andrew Romerdahl as the first ever Widener chair. Part of Romerdahl's duties will be to attract new students and keep them there. He says the job placement statistics for recent graduates of similar programs around the U.S. are impressive, and should make the program an easy sell to prospective students.
You're talking 95, 97, 98%. Almost every student that passes through there is landing a job directly out of the program. So that's the part that's really exciting for me.
This new program may look similar to a previous program that was housed within the College of Business and Public Policy's Finance Department. But according to Professor Terry Fields, there are a number of differences.
You're going to see a brand new curriculum, and it's been switched under a management degree, which was felt to be a more appropriate degree to house it under. And the largest thing you're going to see is the designation attainment now and the new curriculum that's been developed under that program.
The department hopes to graduate between 25 and 30 students per year, and the first ones could receive their degrees as soon as 2015. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The tallest peak in North America is not as tall as previously thought. That's according to new data from a federal and state effort to provide more detailed topographical maps of Alaska. Denali was measured at 20,237 feet, 83 feet shorter than maps indicate today. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell made the announcement at a meeting of map collectors gathered in Fairbanks this week. In a media release, Treadwell says, "The good news is Denali is still the tallest peak in North America." Denali's updated height was recorded with radar technology, which also revealed that an entire ridgeline of Mount Dickey in Denali National Park was missing from previous maps. And Denali National Park is the end point of an epic horse pack trip. Gunter Wamser of Germany and Sonja Edelweber of Austria recently spent a week riding through Denali, the last leg of a horse packing journey Wamser began two decades ago in Argentina.
And I was figuring that it takes me 4 to 5 years to get all the way to Alaska, but things changed, and it's not traveling anymore. It's my way of living.
Wamser says the slow journey was restricted to warmer months as the trip progressed north. He was joined by Edelweber for the North American portion of the trip. Wamser says the going got a lot tougher in the Yukon and Alaska backcountry.
Alaska or the Yukon is a really beautiful country, but it's not really a horse country. So I really do prefer a nice trail for the horses.
Wamser says the Alaska portion of the ride started at the border crossing at Beaver Creek, Yukon, and proceeded west through Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, the Alaska Range, and Denali National Park, where the couple's journey concluded on September 2nd. He says they used gravel bars and game rails to piece together a route, but taking care of their horses also dictated their travel.
The horses eat what they found out there, like grass. So we have to look on our way where is enough feed for the horses, and there is where we rest for the night.
Wamser says they used Mustang horses acquired through a Bureau of Land Management program for the North American portion of the trip. He says completion of the Argentina to Alaska trip will not end their adventures. The couple, who supported themselves by writing books and speaking, want to do more horse packing. The University of Alaska Anchorage has a new athletic director, naming Keith Hackett to lead the department. After a tumultuous past several months, Vice Chancellor of Administrative Services Bill Spindle believes Hackett is the right person to help heal the program.
Keith is a guy that has a tremendous reputation in the athletic world for being a relationship builder, somebody who knows the business, who works well with people both inside the university and outside, and that's what we're looking for.
Hackett replaces Steve Cobb, who was fired in May after questions arose about his handling of a 2011 incident where former hockey coach Dave Shayak struck a player with a stick during practice. Hackett comes to UAA with 36 years of higher education experience, serving the last 9 years as a senior associate athletic director for internal affairs at the University of Nevada. He's expected to start work on October 1st.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Members of the Anchorage Tea Party and libertarian groups have filed an application to put a ballot measure before voters that would prevent the municipality from deducting union dues directly from employee paychecks. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Glenn Beagle is a conservative AM radio talk show host in Anchorage who signed on to the application for the ballot measure. He explains it like this.
The essence of the proposal is that the city should not be responsible for collecting the union's dues. That if people want to pay their union dues, that should be done through them writing their own checks.
Beagle says he's a Tea Party member and he supports recent labor relations changes in states like Wisconsin. The ballot measure, Beagle says, would serve as an alternative for voters to another proposed ballot measure concerning Ordinance 37. The controversial ordinance, which was passed by the Anchorage Assembly in March, limits performance pay, benefits, and strikes, and allows some municipal jobs to be contracted out. The application for the ballot measure was submitted last week. City attorneys are reviewing it. The municipal election is scheduled for April 1st. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
About 250 panhandle business, government, and nonprofit leaders will gather in Sitka next week. It's the annual meeting of the Southeast Conference. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld looks at what's on the agenda.
This year's meeting will look toward the sea. That's according to Shelley Wright, executive director of the Southeast Conference, which is headquartered in Juneau.
We're really focusing on the maritime industry in Southeast Alaska, the seafood industry, some of the transportation industry pieces in Southeast Alaska, workforce development, trying to get back to the small business and how we can grow as a region by growing our businesses.
The organization has been in the middle of a number of efforts to reinvigorate the region's logging and wood processing industry. They include the many-membered Tongass Futures Roundtable and Governor Sean Parnell's Alaska Timber Task Force. Wright says the conference will announce plans at the meeting for its own effort.
To try to manage the Tongass in a way that's going to create a universal strategy for habitat as well as resource development.
And isn't that something that the Forest Service is already doing?
We would like to show them a better way.
The Southeast Conference meeting will include the release of an annual economic roundup for the region. A variety of speakers and panelists will also talk about mining, transportation, and vocational training.
It really is a one-stop shopping event where you have access to leadership throughout the region and state.
Robert Venables of Haines is the organization's energy coordinator.
We have agency participation, and the communities all have an opportunity to do lessons learned and share experiences of what they've been accomplishing, what they hope to accomplish, and how we're doing.
Yakutat, for example, is trying to be the first Alaska community to use wave power to generate electricity. The conference will get an update from Columbia Power Technologies, a Lower 48 company working on the project. Venables says a variety of speakers will provide updates on hydropower, biomass, and other energy projects throughout the region. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
A 14-foot-long dinosaur sculpture, affectionately called Birdie, is missing from the Matanuska Valley Museum. The artwork was stolen from the museum during a break-in this summer, and its owners want it back. No questions asked. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Birdie is a 6-foot-high reproduction of a juvenile Albertosaurus. That's a real dinosaur, which is first cousin to the terrifying Tyrannosaurus rex. Carmen Summerfield, who's president of the Valley Arts Alliance, says Birdie is the creation of 5 artists, including herself.
So it's a dinosaur replica of an Albertosaurus. Those bones were found in northern Alaska, and we started off with a
an aluminum backpack frame, and then welded some more supports around that, and then we covered it with upholstery foam material, and then especially the head of the dinosaur, it moves the head, the mouth opens, and the eyes light up and stuff, so that's really neat.
Birdie was born at Arctic Fires Bronze in Palmer a couple of years ago for the 2011 Valley Wearable Art and Runway Fashion Show.
One person can wear it, and you strap the legs to your feet. So when you move with it, the nice thing is with the tail, there's a little bit of balance there. So it moves like it's a real thing. It doesn't come across as robotic.
The sculpture is brightly painted green and yellow and has since made the rounds of arts events and local fiestas, until July, that is, when Birdie was stolen from storage. Sherry Jackson, executive director of the Museum of Alaska Transportation and Industry in Wasilla, says Birdie was nabbed from a barn on the museum's grounds, and the evidence points to teenage vandals.
Morning of July 3rd, we had discovered some fire extinguishers had been expended in our parking lot. And so then we looked around and saw where the barn doors were open. There was some graffiti left on the parking lot and also inside my office.
And Birdie was gone. Jackson filed a vandalism report with the police, but says the dinosaur is still out there somewhere. Summerfield is offering two free tickets to the Alliance's next wearable art show in February as an inducement to finding Birdie's whereabouts. She says so far she's received no tips and no ransom note.
If they let us know where it is, you know, we can come and pick it up. You know, that's no problem, because that's probably part of the problem, too, is how do you transport it? If we can just get a tip of where it is, we'll pick it up.
Birdie is described as having glowing eyes and very white teeth. The whole 6 foot by 14 foot dinosaur weighs in at about 35 pounds. Birdie would be hard to miss, and his creators miss him too. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Ann Hillman from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.